Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Commissioner Clark, and seated to my left is Chairman Ron Allen, and seated to his left is Commissioner Thad LaVar. This is a time that we have noticed for a hearing to examine advice letter number 14-02 in docket 14-035-TO2 pertaining to proposed Schedule 32 service from renewable energy facilities. And we propose first to have the parties' counsel enter their appearances, introduce their witnesses, and then to discuss any preliminary matters that counsel desire to raise. And let's begin with Rocky Mountain Power.
Good morning. Yvonne Hogle on behalf of Rocky Mountain Power. With me here today to testify are Mr. Dave Taylor and Mr. Bruce Griswold on behalf of the company.
Good morning. Patricia E. Schmid with the Attorney General's Office on behalf of the Division of Public Utilities. With me as the division's witness today is Mr. Charles H. Peterson. Mr. Peterson will be adopting as his the testimony pre-filed by Dr. Abdinasser Abdullah. Thank you.
Rex Olson representing the Office of Consumer Services and Cheryl Murray will be our witness.
Good morning. Sophie Hayes with Utah Clean Energy, and here as Utah Clean Energy's witness is Ms. Sarah Wright.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, or Mr. Commissioner. Gary Dodge on behalf of, I've appeared in this docket on behalf of two clients. One is the UAE Intervention Group, and Mr. Kevin Higgins will testify on its behalf today. Separately, I've intervened on behalf of Powder Corp. And on behalf of Powder Corp, we filed direct testimony of Brent Giles. He is not able to be here because of a back surgery, and has requested that his comments be accepted as comments, as public comments, rather than as testimony. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other appearances? Any preliminary matters? Yes, please. Thank you very much. Any others? Preliminary matters. We have a motion that was filed by InterWest, and a response was filed. Does anyone want to address that motion briefly?
Your Honor, Rex Olson, I'll address that motion. It's our contention that both the office and the division, that in as much as that testimony was filed, but the witness is not here and available for cross-examination, that it should not be treated as testimony, but merely as comment. That was our request, so I so move.
And thank you for your filing in that regard. Is there any further comment on that matter?
The division supports the motion.
Thank you.
Rocky Mountain Power would also support the motion. Thank you.
Okay. Is there any opposition? The motion's granted, and the statement or testimony that was pre-filed will be received as public comment, as will the documents presented by the City of Salt Lake. Any other preliminary matters? I have just one more, and that is, and this may be addressed in the summary of witnesses, but we'd like you to know that we're mindful of the recommendation of at least a couple of the witnesses that the commission consider requesting briefing regarding the meaning of Section 54-17-8053B, and specifically the term monthly metered kilowatt demand measurement and how that might relate to the proposals before the commission. And we'd like to hear the parties' positions on that. And we propose to do that after the first break to give you a little opportunity to discuss that if you didn't anticipate addressing that this morning. And we'll allow about a 15-minute time frame for the break. That should happen somewhere around 10:30 or so. So is that acceptable? Is there any objections to that process? Okay. Well, if there's nothing else to address before we begin to hear from witnesses, Ms. Hogel.
Good morning. The company calls Mr. Dave Taylor, and I believe he needs to be sworn.
Thank you. Do you solemnly swear that the testimony you're about to give shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
Yes, I do.
Thank you very much. Mr. Taylor, please be seated.
Can you please state your name and your position for the record?
My name is David L. Taylor. I'm the manager of regulatory affairs for the state of Utah for Rocky Mountain Power. My street address is 201 South Main Street, Suite 2300, Salt Lake City, Utah, 84111.
And how long have you been employed with Rocky Mountain Power?
I will have been there 35 years in about 2 weeks.
And in what would you say is your area of expertise?
I've spent over 30 of those years in the pricing and regulatory areas of the company. I think with the majority of that time has been focused on cost of service and rate design issues. I prepared my first cost of service study in 1982, and I believe I first testified before this commission on cost of service and rate design in 1988. Though I will say it's been a while since I've been in this seat.
And in that capacity, did you prepare or cause to be prepared direct rebuttal and surrebuttal testimony and accompanying exhibits in this case?
I did.
And do you have any changes to any of that testimony?
I do not.
I'd like to move for the admission as evidence Mr. Taylor's direct rebuttal, surrebuttal, accompanying exhibits in the record.
Any objections? It's received.
Thank you. Mr. Taylor, typically I would ask you if you would like to provide a summary for the commission and everybody present. But given the complexity of this tariff, I'm going to break that up by asking specific questions about the company's proposed Schedule 32. Is that okay?
Well, that's okay with me.
Okay, first, can you provide some background on how Schedule 32 came to be?
Certainly. Schedule 32 was developed to implement Senate Bill 12 that was passed by the Utah State Legislature in 2012. Senate Bill 12 allows a customer that desires to have a larger portion of its electrical service provided from renewable energy sources than is currently included in the company's resource portfolio. They can do that by contracting to receive power and energy from a specific renewable energy facility. Now, customers already have had the opportunity to put renewable energy generation behind their meter on their own property, but most customers don't have enough room or enough real estate on their business site to do that. So what Senate Bill 12 does is provides them an opportunity to get renewable energy from a renewable resource facility that's located at a location different from where the customer takes power. I'll just say that I was personally involved in the crafting of Senate Bill 12 from its initial conceptual development through the drafting of the language and its presentation before the legislature.
And what would you say guided the development of SB 12?
I believe there were three overriding principles that guided the development of Senate Bill 12. First, if a customer wants to be served by renewable energy, they ought to be able to do that. I think in the words of Senator Manson, who was the sponsor of the bill, if if someone wants to buy organic tomatoes, they ought to be able to buy organic tomatoes. That was his analogy. Second, that the customer receiving renewable energy ought to bear all of the costs associated with acquiring and delivering that energy to the customer. And third, the customers who receive renewable energy should pay the utility standard tariff rate prices for the electric service that it requires and receives from the utility beyond those provided from the renewable energy facility. Rocky Mountain Power made an advice filing in April of this year presented Schedule 32. It was designed to comply with Senate Bill 12 and to incorporate those overriding principles that I've just described.
And is there an important point that you think should be kept in mind in reviewing proposed Schedule 32?
Yeah, well, when Rocky Mountain Power prepared Schedule 32, it was designed to treat the customer in the renewable generation facility in very much the same way as if that generator were located behind the customer's meter. Obviously, because it's located somewhere differently, delivery charges have to be taken into account. But we try to design the tariff so that the impact on the customer is very much the same as if that generator were behind the customer's meter.
And what has transpired during the course of this case?
Well, since we made that initial filing, there have been several technical conferences held and a number of discussions between the parties in the case. There have been three rounds of testimony filed. The company has made a number of revisions to the initial tariff in response to suggestions and proposals and testimony made by the parties along the way in this case. And we did that in the cases where we felt that those recommendations were reasonable, where they were in compliance with the tariff, or whether in compliance with the statute, and where we felt they made improvements over what was originally filed. The company also made a few modifications to the tariff where some of the parties felt and argued that it was not in full compliance with the Senate Bill 12 statute. As I discuss the elements of the tariff, I'll explain where these modifications were made and the reasons that Rocky Mountain Power agreed to make some of those changes.
So how does proposed Schedule 32 work?
Well, before I go through a description of the tariff itself, let me first say that I acknowledge that the tariff's pretty complex. Many customers have complained or at least commented on the fact that it's quite complex. However, it's necessary in this case to ensure that the tariff, number one, complies with Senate Bill 12, and two, that the customer pays appropriate costs for the services that are being provided. Because customers taking Schedule 32 service receive electricity from sources other than Rocky Mountain Power, they may or they may not require all of the company's services during a given month or on any given day. Therefore, it was necessary to unbundle the current tariff rate that customers pay to ensure that customers are paying for those individual services that they receive. A customer under Schedule 32 ought to pay only for the services they receive from the company, but to avoid shifting costs to other customers, they should pay for all the services that they receive from the company. So let me now walk through the key elements of the tariff and how it was intended to work. First, the customer obviously is going to pay the cost of renewable power and energy that comes from the renewable energy facility. Those costs are passed directly through to the customer. And to accommodate this, Rocky Mountain Power purchases the electricity from the renewable energy facility, and then we resell that same power to the customer at the very same price that it's acquired from the renewable energy facility. Now, Rocky Mountain Power purchases and resells electricity for two reasons. First, in Utah, a third-party generator cannot sell directly to a retail customer. So to accommodate that, we purchase the power and resell it to the customer. But even as the tariff allows and as the statute allows, the customer can own that renewable facility themselves. But even if the customer owns that facility, it's necessary for Rocky Mountain Power to take ownership of that electricity in order to qualify for network transmission service that's then used to deliver the power to the customer. Now, this is one part of the tariff. I don't think there's any disagreement among the parties. Everyone agrees that the customers ought to pay the full cost coming from that renewable energy facility. Now, the tariff has a customer charge and an administrative fee. The customer charge, as in the current proposal before the commission, is the same as a customer repair on the otherwise applicable general service schedule. That would be Schedule 6, 8, or 9, depending upon size and voltage level of the customer. The company originally had proposed a higher customer charge, one that was derived or linked to the customer charges in the current partial requirement schedule, Schedule 32. But after reviewing some of the comments from the parties, we agreed that perhaps that would perhaps was an overcharge there, particularly since we have the administrative fee as well. And so we agreed in our rebuttal testimony and currently before the commission to move those customer charges to the same as the otherwise applicable general service tariff. Now, there's an administrative fee along with the customer charge, and that's to really cover the cost of manual data collection and billing. This is, again, it's a complicated tariff. The current billing system is not designed to deal with this type of service on a fully automated basis, so each of these billings would have to be done by hand. Our original estimates came to an administrative fee of $450 for every delivery point. There was quite a bit of pushback on that, and probably understandably so. Some parties felt that we hadn't supported or justified that, or clearly not explained the reasons for it enough. And so we went and asked our billing team to go back and refocus and resharpen their pencils and looked at what they the minimum cost they really thought they could do it for. They came back with a 16-step process that they felt was necessary to do a manual billing, all the way from collecting the data from the generator all the way through reviewing and issuing the bill to the customer. That 16-step process came to about 3.5 hours, and at $75 an hour, that came to $260. And that's what we proposed in our rebuttal testimony. The DPU, UAE, and Utah Clean Energy have suggested that some of those 16 steps in that process really relate more to the collection of data from the generation facility, and they would not be repeated if a single customer had more than one delivery point. You would only have to collect that data from the generation source once. And so they suggested that an administrative fee should be lower cost for customers that have more than one delivery point. They recommended that that fee should be $150 for each additional delivery point, suggesting that $110 of that fee would be related to collecting data from the generator. We reviewed that position and felt that actually there was some merit to that, and they went back again to our billing team and ask them if the suggestions and made by the division and others made sense, and they said, yeah, that's probably right. And so what we've suggested, or what I'm suggesting now, was we actually take that $260 and split it into two pieces, $110 for the generator and then $150 for each delivery point. What that means is that if in the case where there's one generator and one customer, they would pay $260, the $110 plus the $150. If a customer had multiple delivery points, then it would be $150 for each additional delivery point. However, the tariff and the statute also allow that there can be more than one generation source serving a single customer or a group of customers. And so we would propose that when there are more than one generation source, that there be a $110 fee for each additional generation source. So if a customer had two generation sources, they'd pay $110 twice to collect data from two generation sources, then $150 for manually calculating the bill for each delivery point. So again, just separated into those two functions, one cost for the generator, a separate cost for each delivery point. The tariff has a delivery charge, and this is the one area where it's different than most customers with their own generation, is this generation is located at some place different from where the customer uses the power. And so all of the energy that the customer uses has to be to come across the company's transmission and distribution system. Now, when the renewable energy facility is generating enough electricity to meet the customer's usage requirements, Rocky Mountain Power delivers that electricity from the renewable facility to the customer. At other times, when the renewable energy facility is either not generating at all or generating less than the customer's requirements, Rocky Mountain Power then delivers electricity to the customer from our own generation resources. Now, to avoid charging the customer twice for using the same transmission and distribution system, the tariff has proposed a single delivery charge, regardless of whether the generation is coming from the renewable energy facility or from other customer generation resources. And that's another reason why it was necessary to make these facilities qualify for network transmission service, so you could deliver from multiple sites to get to the customer. Now, to calculate the rate for the delivery charge, it's necessary to separate the demand component that's in the current general service tariff between a delivery component and a generation component. So the delivery charge, as we've proposed, it is based on the transmission and distribution components from the functionalized cost of service study that was presented in the last general rate case, which was the basis to set the current rates that we have in Utah today. With the delivery cost removed, then, the remaining portion of the combined facilities charge and power charges in the general service tariff becomes the generation capacity-related component, and I'll talk about that in just a minute in my summary. Now, there's a minor difference between how the company calculated that delivery charge and that proposed by UAE witness Kevin Higgins. He proposes a similar but slightly different approach for separating the delivery component from the generation component out of the general service rate. And as I said in my rebuttal testimony, while the two approaches produce slightly different rates, either approach is reasonable. However, I don't agree with Mr. Higgins' representation that under my approach, the Schedule 32 customers would pay a different effective rate for delivery service than they do under their general service, than their general service counterparts. Since the current rate in the general service tariff is not unbundled, there isn't an identifiable delivery component. And so you have to separate that out. So I'm not quite sure why he says they would be paying different than the general service tariff, since that's not broken out currently. But again, either approach, either the way we did it or the way UAE proposed doing it, is reasonable, and I think they're both conceptually sound. The tariff also has a daily power charge that covers the cost of the company providing generation capacity during periods when the renewable energy facility is either not generating or generating at less than its full capacity. The daily power charge includes the remaining generation demand-related costs included in the applicable general service tariff. Now, I take those remaining costs, and they're divided by the average number of on-peak days in the month to arrive at a rate which was billed during on-peak hours each day. There's also a small adjustment to that to account for the difference between a customer's average daily peak and their single monthly peak. But the main goal here is taking that charge, which generally is billed monthly, and separating it into a daily charge. And again, for a general service customer, they would pay that on the highest 15 minutes of their greatest use any time in the whole month. When customers provide some of their own energy requirements or from their own generation resources, such as we have here in this tariff, Schedule 32, or happens under our partial requirements tariff, Schedule 31, again, we break that down to a daily rate. And moving to daily charges acknowledges that these customers, number one, they're not full requirements customers, and second, it provides the customers with an opportunity to avoid demand-related generation cost on days that service is not required from Rocky Mountain Power. When a renewable energy facility is able to meet the customer's peak load requirements during the on-peak hours of the day, the customer won't pay that charge for that day. But on days when the renewable energy facility is not able to meet the customer's peak load requirements, the customer will pay that daily charge for service that day. The daily power charge is designed in such a way that if a customer requires the company to provide its full capacity requirement every day during the month, that that customer would pay essentially the same in the combination of the delivery charge and the daily power charge as that customer would have paid for the demand component under the general service tariff.
What is the major point of contention regarding the company's proposed Schedule 32, Mr. Taylor?
Well, before I answer that, I see I left out a couple of points I need to make. I apologize for that. Finally, all energy that's consumed by the customer beyond that which is provided from the renewable energy facility is billed under our applicable general service kilowatt-hour rates. And any supplemental power and energy, that's power and energy requirements beyond the contractual capacity of that renewable energy facility, is also billed at otherwise applicable general service tariff rates. Okay, now you want to ask your question again.
So what is the major point of disagreement, would you say, among the parties as far as the company's Schedule 32 tariff?
Several parties argue that under the proposed structure of Schedule 32, particularly the 15-minute demand measurement in the daily power charge that we just discussed, that participating customers will receive very little, if any, credit against their bills for the capacity provided from the renewable energy facilities. That's not necessarily true. It really depends on the energy source of the renewable energy facility. Just a case in point, if a customer is receiving power from a geothermal plant or a waste heat from natural gas compression, as several customers have suggested they may do, that generation facility very well may fully offset the customer's billing demand, and they wouldn't pay those daily charges. On the other hand, if the generation is solar or wind, while those facilities may indeed provide generation during some of that on-peak period, it's unlikely that the solar or wind will provide a significant reduction to the customer's billing demand because of the daily generation profile and the intermittent nature of those generation resources. Now, the impact of solar or wind generation on the customer's billing demand is the same under Schedule 32 as it would be if that generator were located on the customer's premises behind their meter. And if we change how we bill demand for Schedule 32 customers, those customers, I believe, would receive a preferential treatment not available to other customers that have a similar generation source behind their meter. And again, treating those customers similarly was one of our objectives when we developed Schedule 32. Now, Senate Bill 12 is very clear that customers using this service are to be billed for all delivered service at the company's applicable tariff rates with adjustments for kilowatts and kilowatt hours delivered from their renewable energy facility. The statute even specifically states the contract customer's monthly metered kilowatt demand measurement. Under company tariffs, billing demands are calculated using the 15-minute period of greatest use. Therefore, the minimal impact of solar or wind generation on a customer's billing demand is really a function of, first, the daily generation profile and intermittent nature of those generation resources, and second, how the demand component of tariff rates are billed. So the fact that that solar and wind may produce very little, if any, offset to the customer's billing demands is really not a function of how Schedule 32 is structured, but it's a function, again, of the intermittent nature of those resources and how billing demand in general is dealt with. Now, if parties want to change the basic structure of Rocky Mountain Power's rates, they're certainly free to make those arguments in a general rate case and have those addressed before the commission. But if we're to restructure the concept of billing demand only for Schedule 32 and allow them to avoid what I believe are legitimate costs, we very likely would be shifting costs to other customers, and I'm not sure that that's what the intent of the tariff is.
So what is your response to some of the other approaches regarding the daily power charge?
Well, let me specifically address the recommendation made by UAE witness Kevin Higgins. While Mr. Higgins considers a daily power charge a useful construct, he proposes to make the charge even more granular by converting it into what he calls an hourly on-peak shaping charge. I don't agree with that approach for a couple of reasons. First, at that level of granularity, the proposed hourly on-peak shaping charge ceases, in my opinion, to be a demand-related charge and simply becomes additional energy or kilowatt-hour charge. I think that option is inconsistent with how other rates are designed, including rates for customers that have generation behind their meter. I don't think that's good rate design. I don't think it's supported by the language of Senate Bill 12, the statute, which, as I pointed out earlier, points to the contract customer's monthly metered kilowatt-hour demand measurement.
Do you have any final comments, Mr. Taylor?
I would encourage the commission to approve Schedule 32 as it's currently proposed by Rocky Mountain Power, and that concludes my summary. Thank you.
The witness is available for questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Schmidt.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Taylor.
Morning.
In your summary, you put forth a new method proposed for calculating the administrative fee for Schedule 32. You divided the administrative fee into two parts, a generation part and a delivery part. Is that right?
Yeah, the part for collecting data from the generator and the part for creating the bill for the customer, yes.
Do you recall the testimony of the division's witness, Dr. Abdinasser Abdullah, where he talked about economies of scale?
Yes.
Do you recall that Dr. Abdullah's testimony, and as mentioned in Mr. Peterson's testimony, set a 10-meter cap for an economy of scale benefit?
I remember that, yes.
Does the company propose any sort of cap, either on the number of meters that will qualify for the split fee or the generation sources, or is it unlimited?
I think it would be unlimited. However, I think that getting beyond 10, either generators or customer delivery points, is probably unlikely.
You also talked about the 15 minutes of greatest use concept. Do you recall that?
Yes.
Do Schedules 8 and 9 incorporate that 15 minutes of greatest use concept into their rate design?
They do.
Thank you. Those are all my questions.
Mr. Olson?
We have no questions.
No questions. Thank you.
Mr. Dodge?
Good morning, Mr. Taylor.
Morning.
A couple quick questions. You criticize Mr. Higgins' daily demand charge hourly demand charge proposal, partly on the grounds that you read the statute to require a monthly measurement, and yet the company's is a daily measurement, correct?
That's correct.
So you've already walked away from the notion that it has to be based just on a one-time monthly measured demand to a 22 or 20, however many on-peak days there are, measured demand, correct?
That's correct, and we did that so we would treat them consistently to customers who had generation behind their meter, because that's how that's billed for them.
So let's talk about it. So under Schedule 31, it is not required that there be a one monthly measured amount, right? Now, Schedule 31 already incorporates a daily.
That's correct.
And so there's nothing in the law that you're aware of, is there, or in the statutes or anything that says that you can't define measured demand in any way the commission approves?
Objection. Let's
take away the legal part. Let's leave out for right now Senate Bill 12. Are you aware of anything in the commission orders or tariffs or anywhere else that says you have to use a one-time monthly measurement versus a daily or other measurement?
No, but I do believe that going to hourly eliminates the concept of demand altogether. And then regardless of whether it's allowable under the statute, I still wouldn't support it.
and I understand you wouldn't, but your hourly, I mean, your daily, again, is a diversion from a one-time monthly charge.
Yes, I agree with that.
And it isn't actually an energy charge. It's an on-peak energy charge. It's only charged over 8 on-peak hours during the summer, correct, under Mr. Higgins' proposal?
That's correct. And our current schedules for large customers have different energy charges for on- and off-peak periods. So this would be an additional energy charge during the on-peak period.
Right, an on-peak energy charge, which is different than a 24/7 energy charge.
That's correct, as is currently incorporated into Schedules 8 and 9 today.
And then you say you're trying to remain similar to Schedule 31. How many behind-the-meter solar farms are you aware of in the state of Utah?
Well, we have a number of customers that have behind-the-meter solar.
On their rooftops?
Well, they have it on their property. I don't know where they're physically located, but we have customers that have behind-the-meter solar.
And don't you agree, though, that Senate Bill 12 and Schedule 32 is aimed at a different process than behind-the-meter? In other words, your normal behind-the-meter generator is a cogen or emergency backup generators or something like that, not a renewable facility like a wind farm or a solar farm. Don't you agree with that?
Well, you've asked two or three questions there, so can I try to pick them out
Please.
One at a time? Yes, Schedule 32 is different from Schedule 31 in that the generation source is located somewhere else. But we do have customers on the partial requirement Schedule 31, that have the behind-the-meter renewable generation.
Can you give us an example of one and the size of it? I mean, I'm aware of one of my customers with a very, very small, but I'm trying to understand, are you trying to create a similarity requirement that doesn't really exist, or is there a lot of renewable energy behind the meters out there that you're aware of?
Well, the one that comes quickest to my mind is Tooele Army Depot that has quite a bit of renewable generation on their facility.
And what do they have?
They have, I know they have solar, and they have a couple of other renewable sources there.
And what size?
I don't know the size right off the top of my head, but it's several megawatts.
You talk about shifting costs to other customers. You acknowledge, though, do you not, that if there's value in the on-peak hours when a solar, for example, or wind facility is generating, and under your proposal, unless they offset the entire daily on-peak demand, they will get no benefit for that on-peak energy. Correct?
They will get no reduction to their demand billing for that day. That's correct.
Right. So is that not shifting costs the other way, if there's value? If you assume that there's value in on-peak generation, even if it misses one 15-minute increment in the 8-hour period, do you agree that there's a value there that's not being compensated for or credited under your proposal for Schedule 32?
To the same extent that a customer who has a peak in their demand for 1 hour or one day during the month may pay maybe a bigger charge than a fully cost allocated charge would have for them. But again, that's consistent with how rates are billed. So there may be situations where there is some on-peak benefit being provided from the customers that's not fully compensated under the tariff. That's correct.
And if that's
I believe that going to Mr. Higgins' proposal would go the other direction.
And if it's the case that this may not adequately compensate someone for their on-peak generation, perhaps the answer to keeping Schedules 31 and 32 similar is to change 31 and not to make 32 have the same deficit. Would you not agree with that?
Well, you can certainly argue to change any tariff schedule when we come before the commission. I'll just say that we just barely established rates for under Schedule 31 by stipulation, which I think your client was a signatory.
And I think a client, not probably UA. I believe it was U.S. Magnesium that was a signatory.
Okay.
But my point is there's no need to keep them similar if it means they're both undercompensating the customer for on-peak generation. Wouldn't you agree with that?
Again, if UAE wants to come and make recommendations to change how we have our current rate structures, they're welcome to do that in a rate case.
I'm not talking about general rate structures. I'm talking about one that's being set today in this hearing for Schedule 32. Shouldn't that be the best rate regardless of whether there's another schedule that arguably ought to be changed in the future?
I think consistency is important.
Thank you. No further questions.
I just have a few questions.
Ms. Rhodes.
Thank you. Do you agree that when the company developed Schedule 32, it focused on the 2-megawatt minimum size requirement when it calculated the rates using cost of service and current rates for Schedules 8 and 9 for service over 1 megawatt?
Well, I'm not quite sure I fully understand your question. If you're asking me, when we first presented the tariff, did we only look at customers over 1 megawatt in size? Answer to that is yes, but we rectified that in our rebuttal case.
Can you talk a little bit about that rectification, that proposal?
Yeah. It was suggested that as we laid out the prices for delivery and for daily demand charges, that they were based off of rate schedules 8 and 9, which are designed strictly for customers larger than 1 megawatt. And the statute allows, and the tariff does allow, for one customer entity to aggregate multiple delivery points, even though those individual delivery points are smaller than 2 megawatts, to meet that 2-megawatt threshold to qualify for the tariff. And some of those may be smaller than 1 megawatt in size. And I acknowledge that that's correct, and it was an oversight on our part when we originally developed the tariff. That's why we, in our rebuttal, modified the tariff to have charges for customers smaller than 1 megawatt, and those are derived from the General Service Schedule 6, which is for distribution voltage customers under 1 megawatt. Under 1 megawatt.
No further questions. Thank you.
I'm sorry, Ms. Rhodes, are you
No further
finished?
Questions. Thank you.
Oh, thank you very much. Redirect.
The company has no redirect.
Thank you. Questions from the commission?
It's a high-tech solution. Mr. Taylor, I'm curious. Ms. Murray proposed that Schedule 32 in her testimony should include all surcharge adjustments such as Schedule 91, the low income, 94, the EBA, the RECs, the solar schedules, but I believe you just addressed 193, which is the DSM schedule. Can you explain the company's position on what those schedules should look like?
We agree with Ms. Murray that and it is our intent that customers taking service under Schedule 32 would be subject to all of those surcharges and credits that are applied to other bills. We actually need to fix all of our tariffs in that regard to make the language more clear, and we will fix Schedule 32 accordingly.
Okay, great. Thanks for clarifying that.
Good morning, Mr. Taylor.
Morning.
Taking you back to the question of consistency between Schedules 31 and 32, do you have anything more to say on that subject to us? And I mean by that, are we talking about consistency for consistency's sake, or are there reasons deeper than that that a schedule that was adopted by stipulation or was presented through a stipulation to the commission and Schedule 32 need to be consistent?
Well, first of all, I do think it is important to treat customers that have their own generation sources consistently, whether it's behind the meter or located somewhere else. But I also think the way we've proposed to structure the tariff is designed, again, to give those customers an opportunity to avoid demand charges if they can generate across the peak demand period in any given day, rather than charging them for a whole month if they just hit it one time. So consistency is important, but I also think the way we've structured the tariff is appropriate for these type of customers.
Changing subjects, I'm going to ask you about a detail that you may or may not be conversant with this morning. But as we looked at your development of the customer charge piece, it seemed to us that for Schedule 6 and 8, or with respect to those schedules, you drew on the most recent rate case, but with respect to Schedule 9, you drew on the 11035-200 rate case incorporate the customer charge. Are you aware of that distinction in the sources?
If I did, that was an oversight.
Okay.
They should be equal to the current 6, 8, and 9 tariff rates. If they're not, that was a mistaken oversight on my part.
Thank you. Any further questions?
No further questions from the company. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Taylor, you're excused. Thank you very much. We'll be off the record for a moment. On the record.
The division would like to call as its witness Mr. Charles H. Peterson. Could Mr. Peterson please be sworn?
Do you solemnly swear that the testimony you're about to give shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
Yes.
Please be seated.
Just one moment.
Your Honor, excuse me. We have one more witness, and I was wondering about the order of the witnesses. I apologize.
What's counsel's preference? If you'd like to present your witness now, and there's no objection to that, we can ask Mr. Peterson to wait for a few moments or minutes.
We would, Your Honor. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
The company calls Mr. Bruce Griswold.
We'll remember you've been sworn. Mr. Griswold, apologize for leaping over you in that way.
No worries.
Do you solemnly swear the testimony you're about to give shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Please be seated. Ms. Hogle.
Good morning, Mr. Griswold.
Good morning.
Can you please state your name and your position with the company for the record?
Sure. My name is Bruce Griswold. Spelling is G-R-I-S-W-O-L-D. I'm with Pacific Core, Director of Short-Term Origination and QF Contracts. My address is 825 Northeast Multnomah, Portland, Oregon, 97232.
And in that capacity, did you prepare or cause to be prepared rebuttal and accompanying exhibits for this case?
Yes, I did.
And do you have any changes to your testimony?
I do not.
And so if I were to ask you the questions today that were in your rebuttal testimony, your answers would be the same?
That's correct.
The company moves for the admission of the rebuttal testimony and accompanying exhibits of Mr. Bruce Griswold as evidence.
Any objection? They're received.
Mr. Griswold, do you have a summary that you would like to give today?
Yes, I do.
Please proceed.
So in my rebuttal testimony, I addressed two issues. One was the kind of the contract and confidentiality issues that were raised in the direct testimony of Mr. Verba of Energy of Utah and Mr. Duncan of Ormat, Nevada. I also introduced two form example contracts that the company would expect to use in support of Schedule 32. One is a electric service agreement for renewable energy, and the second is a form of a qualifying facility power purchase agreement, which would be used for purchase of any non-firm renewable energy generated by the renewable energy facility in excess of the customer's load. So I'd like to break this down into the two pieces. One is the confidentiality. The company views that the proprietary business information between the renewable energy facility and the customer is their information and is not meant to be made public, nor would we use that information for any benefit in the marketplace. However, we believe that identifying and classifying what terms should be considered confidential is necessary to maintain the confidentiality of the business deal while also allowing the company to pass through the appropriate costs that can be used to accurately invoice the customer for receipt and delivery of the renewable energy from the renewable energy facility. One of the items that Mr. Verba brought up was the price. And what the company has proposed is to use a proxy price, one, for example, $1 a megawatt hour, that could be provided by the energy facility and the customer for the renewable energy as long as the remaining fees and charges in Schedule 32 are not impacted, thus alleviating the confidentiality concerns on price. There are also other options that could be included around some of the terms between the renewable energy facility and the customer. You know, we could include some reps and warrants in the electric service agreement for renewable energy and the the QF agreement, QF power purchase agreement. I'd also like to speak to the contracts themselves. I introduced and I described two form contracts the company would use. The form electric service agreement and the form QFPPA were designed were not intended to provide anything but be a sample of the types of contracts that would be used under any proposed transaction on Schedule 32. These are separate and distinct from the contract that would be between the generating the renewable energy facility and the customer itself. The first form, the energy service agreement for renewable, is an example of what the contract would be between the company, the renewable energy facility, and the customer. It provides an example of what the terms and conditions look like, which are defined in Schedule 32. This agreement is modeled after the electric service agreement, the partial service requirement agreement under Schedule 31, where a customer uses on-site generation to meet its load and needs with backup and supplemental service provided and an occasional sale to the utility when the generation exceeds load. However, there is one significant difference. In this case, for the electric service agreement for renewable, the generation is located off-site. That requires that there be some additional delivery and hourly true-up aspects to meet Schedule 32. This template agreement would allow for limited modification of the terms and conditions by the parties to meet the specific transaction arrangements that have been set up between the generation, renewable generation, the customer, and the company, but still be in compliance with Schedule 32, the company's electric service regulations, and all other applicable rules and regulations. Second form agreement is the form QF power purchase agreement. It's an addendum to the electric service agreement for purchasing renewable energy that's generated in excess of the customer's load. This form agreement is modeled after the Utah's QF power purchase agreement that's used for compliance with Schedule 37 and 38. This form agreement is the best alternative for purchasing the excess generation from the renewable energy facility. The transaction is a purchase of energy to offset energy that the company would have otherwise purchased in the market, and it also meets FERC requirements for the use of network transmission to acquire that energy from that renewable generator and move it to the company's load. And it also sets the price of energy at the avoided cost. The agreement is consistent with other power purchase agreements used to purchase excess energy from QFs and is in compliance with PURPA and state QF rules and regulations. That concludes my summary.
Mr. Griswold is available for cross-examination or for questions from the bench. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Schmidt.
No questions.
No questions.
Wilson.
No questions. Thank you.
Mr. Dodge.
Good morning, Mr. Griswold. A few questions. You've indicated that the contracts attached to your testimony are forms and that there's some limited modifications will be allowed. I assume you're not asking the commission to approve these forms per se. They're more for illustrative purposes. Is that correct?
That's correct.
You discussed the proxy price approach or alternative approaches to maintaining confidentiality. I understand your testimony to mean the company is willing to do that upon the customer's request.
That's correct, yes.
While recognizing that the contracts aren't being approved per se and that you'll be willing to negotiate on a limited basis modifications, there are a few things I did want to ask you about in your form contracts to make sure that there's no, I guess, disagreements. That there are no misunderstandings, I guess, between you and at least me. And the first would be on the first page, if you'll turn to the form ESA, Electric Service Agreement. You indicate on the cover of that it's a three-way agreement, and although in the opening paragraph you only reference the customer, I assume you will add in the renewable energy project owner as a third party. Is that the intent?
Yes.
A couple quick questions in that agreement then. For example, on page 4 of 19 of the form energy contract, under the definition of generation interconnection agreement, you reference large generator interconnection agreement. I suspect most of these may well be small. I assume, do you intend to use either the FERC small SGIA or small generator interconnect agreement or a form attached to the Utah rule for under 20 megawatts if that's a small facility?
We would use the most appropriate interconnection agreement that would be put in place between the renewable energy facility and the Pacific Corp transmission, in this case, the transmission provider.
And you do understand, are you aware that Utah has a specific commission rule dealing with interconnections of up to 20 megawatts?
I am aware, yes.
And this is not intended to suggest under 20 megawatts connections would be under anything but that rule. In other words, it would fall under the commission rule if it's a smaller than 20 megawatt connection, would it not?
Yes. Really the interconnection component of this would be between the project itself, the generating project itself, and Pacific Corp Trans. It's really referenced in here as a necessary element that needs to be, documented that's in place.
And I guess part of the reason I'm asking that is that there is, of course, throughout these agreements, a lot of, they're not us. PacTran is very different. You can't touch them. Don't blame us for them, et cetera, which I understand. But that's at a FERC level, right? And below a FERC level, actually, this commission may have jurisdiction based on its rule of interconnections, even if it's PacTran doing it. You acknowledge, do you not, that it could fall under this commission's jurisdiction if it's small enough?
Objection. Legal question. Only answer if you know the answer.
That's, yeah, I'm just asking his understanding. Obviously, I'm not asking him to rule on it. But
My understanding would...
Pardon me, Mr. Griswold. Mm-hmm. This is a formality, but please answer the question within your own understanding and not in terms of a legal assessment.
Very good. My understanding is, there is the separation between FERC and the state relative to various rules on interconnection. However, I work in the merchant side of the business, and I don't have enough detail to provide probably a strong answer to that.
Fair enough. Thank you. If you'll turn to page 5 of 19, under your definition of net output, it talks in terms of all of the energy and capacity produced by the renewable energy facility. You accept, do you not, that there could be a circumstance where the renewable facility will sell certain number of megawatts to one customer and choose not to sell the rest, the entire output, to either that customer or other customers, might choose to sell it on the open market or might choose to sell it as a QF?
Objection beyond the scope.
Well, I don't think it's beyond the scope because it defines net output as all energy and capacity, and later I'll get into it, says that you customer has to sell all energy and capacity, and I'm trying to confirm that is not your intent, to force a renewable energy facility to sell all of it to one customer or even to a group of customers under Schedule 32.
Mr. Griswold, do you understand the question?
I do. I'm just rereading this. Yes.
Perspective?
Sure. So just from the definition of net output from a generating perspective is really meant to be the energy in excess of the kind of the station service requirements of in the qualifying facility world of supplying their own needs while the unit is operating. Under that definition of qualifying facility and PURPA, the net output simply means that the QF has the obligation and opportunity to sell it to the utility, and the utility has the obligation to buy it. In trying to adapt this to Schedule 32, recognizing you may have a single generator selling to multiple points of delivery or multiple generators selling to multiple points of delivery. We tried to incorporate a definition that at least got to the basic point of that the energy being sold would be sold, the net energy would be sold on a excess basis to the utility. If you step back to the point about this being an example contract, it was meant to show in the simplest manner a single generator and a single receiver with the excess going to the utility. As I mentioned, and Mr. Dodge pointed out that it was a contract that's negotiable. It's meant to be adaptable to limited scales to whatever the project and the customer are doing. And so from that extent, I do accept what Mr. Dodge has said. However, it's going to vary from project to project.
Thank you. If you look briefly at section 2.1, in the middle of that section, it has the phrase that begins, or the sentence that begins, in the event that the commission order approving this agreement requires any change, etc. Is it the company's intent to have each of these Schedule 32 contracts approved by the commission?
That is my understanding.
And then turning to the Addendum A, which is the QF Power Purchase Agreement, the form. Again, in the same way, it's a form, not here for commission approval per se, correct?
Correct.
Do you know whether there's an intent to have a power purchase agreement of this type submitted to the commission for approval? In other words, if a renewable facility signs one of these to sell its excess power, will that come before the commission for approval as well?
Yes, it's an addendum to the electric service agreement. In other words, the expectation is very similar to a partial requirements customer that has generation behind the meter. It also has electric service agreement, and it also has a excess generation, a qualifying facility agreement. And so both of these would go before the commission for approval.
Thank you. And you reference in that agreement the intent is to have pricing consistent with either Schedule 37 or 38. Do I understand that it to be your intent that based on the specific circumstance of the QF, you will either adopt the then current Schedule 37 prices or use the Schedule 38 model to determine prices?
That's correct, based on the size of the project. The generating facility.
Okay, thank you. No further questions.
Ms. Rhodes.
We don't have any questions, Your Honor. Thank you.
Redirect.
No redirect from the company. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from the commission? Thank you, Mr. Griswold. You're excused.
Thank you.
I do have a question for Mr. Taylor, however.
Can I answer from here?
Yeah, please do. And I apologize. I missed something that, and again, this is a detail that, if you'd look at page 14 of your rebuttal, and I'm referring you to table 2 on that page.
Okay.
Toward the bottom of that table, there's a reference to backup energy charges, and then incorporating by reference schedule 6, 8, and 9.
The term backup should probably not be there, if that's your question.
Well, my question was, okay. Because what I was looking for in Schedule 32 was backup energy charges, and if you could help me locate that, or perhaps you're telling me that would be a futile exercise.
Yeah, energy charges, the tariff just refers back to the applicable general service tariff. This is a little sloppy work on my part, carried over from earlier tables when we had a backup concept in the tariff. Also, to clarify your question on the customer charges you asked earlier, I believe that the prices are correct. It was just one of the references to them had the old tariff number on it, but I think the price in here is the current Schedule 9 customer charge.
In dollars, is that $255, yes, or $247, or?
It's current. The current price for is $247, and the next and step two will go to $259.
Okay. Thank you. Anything further, Ms. Hogel? Okay, Ms. Schmidt.
Now would be the proper time for the division to call its witness, Mr. Charles H. Peterson, and we will note, if we can, for the record, that Mr. Peterson was previously sworn in my premature calling of him. And my apologies to Mr. Griswold.
Please be seated, Mr. Peterson.
Okay.
Good morning. Could you please state your full name, employer, business address, and position for the record?
Yes, my name is Charles E. Peterson. I have to correct my attorney. My employer is the Division of Public Utilities. The address is here in the Heber Wells building on the fourth floor. And my current job title is technical consultant.
We note that the division's witness who submitted direct and rebuttal testimony was Dr. Abdunasser M. Abdullah. And we note that you have submitted surrebuttal testimony on behalf of the division. Could you please explain?
Yes. 2 or 3 weeks ago, Dr. Abdullah rather abruptly left the division to take care of some family matters that were going to require potentially a lengthy period of time to resolve.
And
excuse me.
Go ahead.
I think I was basically finished. I was then asked to step in for the division in this matter.
Did you participate on behalf of the division in the preparation of Dr. Abdullah's direct and rebuttal testimony?
Yes, I was a backup to him and assisted him in preparing his testimony previously.
Today, do you adopt Dr. Abdullah's direct and rebuttal testimony as your own?
Yes.
With regard to your surrebuttal testimony, did you prepare that in connection with your participation for the division in this docket?
Yes.
Do you have any corrections to make to that sir rebuttal testimony?
Two corrections for clarification and line 86, although perhaps this is now somewhat moot, but I inconsistently stated 10 meters and it should be 9 meters. And for clarification on line 118, I refer to Utah Code Annotated Chapter 54, 17801, and it should be clarified that I meant all of Part 8 and not just that particular Section 801.
With that explanation and those corrections, the division would like to move for the admission of the direct testimony of Dr. Abdullah, DPU Exhibit Number 1.0, the rebuttal testimony of Dr. Abdullah, DPU Exhibit Number 1.0R, and the surrebuttal testimony of Mr. Charles E. Peterson, Division Exhibit Number 1.0SR.
Any objections? They're received in evidence.
Mr. Peterson, do you have a summary to present today?
Yes, I do.
Please proceed.
Good morning, Commissioners. The Division generally supports the tariff provisions proposed by Rocky Mountain Power in the rebuttal and surrebuttal testimony of Mr. Taylor. And also, at this point, we are prepared to agree with and accept the changed administrative fee that Mr. Taylor testified to a few moments ago. The fee is described by Mr. Taylor in his latest proposal is consistent with what I proposed in my surrebuttal testimony, and in fact, expands beyond what I had originally proposed. And I regret that he did this because it took away a lot of flame and fury that I was prepared to deliver this morning. In the division's view, the company's proposal for Schedule 32 is consistent with other existing tariffs and appears to be based on the view, as Mr. Taylor described earlier, that it's consistent with the view that customers who, instead of having renewable energy within their own property behind the meter, as it's usually described, are instead able to remove that generation to remote locations without requiring the remote generation facility to become a public utility. This generation provided to the customer may be owned by that customer or may be a third party. The division supports this conception of Schedule 32 and its underlying legislation. The capacity issue of maximizing capacity payments that has been raised by some developers and their supporters, the division believes could largely be solved by simply having the developer build the facility as a qualifying facility under PURPA. Moving on, the major issues that the division still sees remaining has to do with the testimony of Mr. Kevin Higgins, representing the UAE Intervention Group. And he has offered an alternative to Schedule 32 that the company has provided. The division understands that there are two primary differences between the company's proposal as set forth in Mr. Taylor's rebuttal testimony and Mr. Higgins' proposal. The first is that Mr. Higgins relies primarily on the terms and numbers set forth in the stipulation in the most recent general rate case, docket number 1305-184. Mr. Taylor, from whom you've just heard, relies upon the company's cost of service study in that same docket, but then makes an across-the-board adjustment of approximately 2% to adjust it to a or to make an adjustment for the stipulation settlement. Two, Mr. Higgins proposes to have hourly shaping charges to cover the costs that might be incurred by a customer when its remote generating facility fails for whatever reason to provide enough power for its needs. Mr. Taylor proposes to provide the daily power charges in a fashion the division believes is consistent with the existing Schedule 31. The company argues and the division agrees that to accept Mr. Higgins' proposal of his shaping charges effectively eliminates the concept of demand charge. And Mr. Higgins, in his own testimony in Sir Rebuttal, seems to agree with that characterization when he says, by making the charge more granular, it indeed converges with an on-peak energy charge, as Mr. Taylor contends, end quote. As to the issue of which data source to use as a basis for Schedule 32 rates, the division is more or less neutral. Neither the stipulation data nor the cost of service study can said to be the one and only one right data source, because absent a new and preferably commission-approved cost of service study, both sets of data do not reflect the actual current costs faced by the company. And furthermore, these rates will necessarily be updated in the next general rate case. However, the division does accept, as I said a moment ago, that the company's accept the company's position that to effectively make demand charges hourly at best creates a new definition of demand charge and at worst makes Schedule 32 inconsistent with existing tariffs and definitions, which in turn would likely eliminate the neutrality of other ratepayers, the neutrality to the Schedule 32 customers. Through the company's cost of service model, allocations and rate designs are interrelated. What Mr. Higgins is proposing and what others support is a fundamental change to the definition of demand, but only for Schedule 32 customers. It is blatantly unfair to manipulate that definition to the benefit of one group of customers without considering the effects on all customers and the company through a general or broad cost of service study and docket. If the commission, however, believes an hourly demand-like charge is appropriate, then the division recommends that the commission should explore doing that across all rate schedules that include demand charges. And the division doesn't believe that this can be done in this docket. But perhaps more importantly, the division has been advised and believes that such a charge as Mr. Higgins is proposing may be contrary to the specific statute, which has been referenced earlier as 5417-805-3B. And as I understood this morning, the commission is going to hear discussion later today on that particular issue. And the division was one of the parties recommending legal briefing on that. The rest of my opening comments was my before-mentioned flame and fury about the administrative fee. The division accepts the company's current proposal, and which of course will subsequently be reviewed in the next general rate case. The division believes that it is important for the commission to approve a schedule to make operational Part 8 of 5417. And once there is actual experience with Schedule 32, customers or the company can bring forward changes to that schedule for the Commission's consideration. And just to reiterate what's already been expressed in other ways, as with all other service, electric service schedules, the first implementation of the schedule does not have to stand for all time. The division recommends that the company, or the, excuse me, the commission approve the tariff sheets as filed with Mr. Taylor's rebuttal testimony, except as he has modified today. Thank you.
Mr. Charles Peterson is now available for cross-examination questions and questions from the commission.
Thank you. Yeah. We're contemplating a recess. Let's have some estimates of cross-examination for Mr. Peterson.
If we have none, Your Honor.
No questions.
Just a couple minutes.
We have none, Your Honor.
Okay. Floor is yours, Mr. Dodge.
Seems to be the only one talking here this morning. Mr. Peterson, good morning.
Hello.
You suggest that if Mr. Higgins' hourly demand component be adopted for Schedule 32, that the Commission needs to look at doing the same thing for all of the other schedules? Is that your testimony?
We believe that there should be a consistency in the demand definition across all schedules. So that is basically the division's recommendation.
So if, as the company has proposed and you have supported, a daily demand component is adopted, then you think all the other schedules should be changed to a daily demand measurement instead of a one time per month?
Well, as Mr. Taylor previously pointed out, Schedule 31 already has effectively a daily demand component to it. So the idea of a daily demand component is not a new concept here. What is a new concept is converting that to an hourly component, and the division believes that needs to be studied. The effects of that across all rate schedules need to be studied.
And did you study that across all rate schedules when it was adopted for Schedule 31?
I don't remember. I don't have knowledge of that.
And why would there be impacts across all rate schedules?
Because of the interrelationship between the allocation in the inner relationship between the cost of service and rate design.
You understand that Schedule 31 is not included in cost of service analyses?
No.
Because it's a partial requirement schedule and they propose the same for Schedule 32, do you not?
I'm sorry, that's beyond my expertise.
Okay. No further. Wait. One other question. You do understand that the proposal to use the concept. Well, first of all, you've talked in terms of payments for capacity. You understand there's no payment here. It's a credit against the customer's otherwise demand charge. Correct?
Yes. I misspoke.
Okay. In terms of that credit, you do understand that Mr. Higgins' proposal to measure the demand credit for Schedule 32 only applies to the portion that is renewable energy. In other words, if I have a 10-megawatt load and I have a 1-megawatt renewable energy, it's only the 1 megawatt that would have the credit calculated in the way Mr. Higgins proposed, not all the other 9 megawatts. You understand that, do you not?
Yes, I think that should be implicit.
Okay. No further questions.
Okay.
Redirect.
Just one. So would it be correct to say that the company proposal that the division endorses is an attempt to harmonize treatment across schedules so there will be no ripple effect, and that under Mr. Higgins' proposal you see a deviation from other schedules that may have a ripple effect?
I think that's a fair characterization, that the division's concerned that changing the definition may may affect other schedules in ways that we don't currently understand.
Thank you.
Thank you. I think there might be a question or two from the commission, but we're going to be in recess until 10:45 before we hear those.